Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, you ever go 8 miles high?
No, I haven't. What happens when you touch down?
You make a country record. Okay. We used to do this thing, Patrick.
Yeah.
We used to be much better about this, where like an album would come out, or an anniversary of an album would come up, and we would talk about that album and be pretty much on time. And then lately we just sort of have let things lapse. We've been busy. We've been doing other topics.
Yeah.
And so now we find ourselves oftentimes playing catch up with the album anniversaries, but that's fine, because then we can group them together and make it like
a little bit
of an experience, right? So we did this before. We had like a week, I think, of album anniversaries. This is just going to be like the next 3 days.
Finish out the week here.
But we're going to do... I like what we have here, because we have some interesting records, I think, from one from each of three different decades.
Yep.
So it's going to be really cool. So
it is going to be cool.
All right. So this is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
It's a music commentary show, as you can hear.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to comment this episode on an album that came out 1968, so that's 50 years ago, August 30th, so we're only a little bit behind here.
Pretty close.
August 30th, 1968, it was The Byrds' Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
Sweetheart of the Rodeo by The Byrds. As you said, Columbia Records, 1968, and I think it's most noted, you know, might as well get it right out there, as the first sort of major band to put out a country rock album.
Yeah, which, looking back now, doesn't seem necessarily like it's that big of a deal.
No.
Because from kind of sort of in the 80s, but really from the 90s on, the whole idea of alt country and now Americana, so whatever you want to call it, has become such a big force in music in a lot of ways, and become so embraced by people to a point where it just seems like a completely normal, natural thing.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it gets lost on people, the idea that, you know, 50 years ago, this was considered kind of radical, right?
Extremely radical.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially coming from a band who was known for folk rock, electrifying folk rock. They were known for that space rock, 12-string Rickenbacker electric sound, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man and 8 Miles High and all that stuff.
Right. They sort of really kind of pioneered a new sound in the 60s that became very much identified with sort of hippie culture.
Yep.
And not only that, but continued to push it forward to the point where the album right before Sweetheart of the Rodeo was considered like a psychedelic
record,
you know, for the most part, right?
The Notorious Byrd Brothers.
Yes.
And at that time, even from the very beginning, I think for the first two, three records, Mr. Tambourine Man, Turn, 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 and Fifth Dimension, the lineup was pretty stable. David Crosby was a big part of it.
Yes.
And, you know, they had Roger McGuinn out there out front, and Chris Hillman was just considered sort of a shadow player, a bass player in the band at that time.
Right.
And, you know, obviously the group, had, I don't know how many number one hits, but mainly were known for covering, you know, Bob Dylan songs, and Gene Clark had written a couple tunes too that were, that were pretty influential, but, by the time Sweetheart of the Rodeo came around, before that, I guess there was only McGuinn and Hillman were the only people left in the group.
Right. So they had those Bob Dylan covers, as you mentioned, the Rickenbacker, the 12 string sound, the jangle pop that became a bigger deal, you know, much later on with, you know, in the like sort of 80s college alternative. They were a big influence on that. They had elements of folk, but also, as I mentioned, the kind of psychedelia, the song 8 Miles High, which of course, you know, is considered a psychedelic, you know, classic, one of those songs that when you first hear it, you're like, what are they doing? It sounds so bizarre. It sounds so crazy. Right. And the whole theme being 8 Miles High when you touch down, you know, all that stuff. And then they also have like a classic rocker, like, So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star,
exactly.
You know, which was a song, an original song that they had. So, and you know, as you mentioned, they had a burst of time there where they were one of the most popular bands of the 60s. And then they sort of felt maybe that their that their time was passing a little bit. Mm-hmm. They needed to change things up. David Crosby left the band, and Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman ended up hiring this guy.
Yeah.
21 years old, I think, at the time.
Yeah, 21
or
like that.
22.
21 or 22.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Graham Parsons.
That's right.
And this ended up really kind of completely changing the band for the, for this one album.
Massively.
It's so bizarre.
It really is.
It's kind of like we talked about last week or the week before. I've already forgotten here. About Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
And how, you know, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks came in and pretty much just kind of like took over the whole sound of the band. Well, that's what happened with Graham Parsons
pretty much.
And the Byrds. So my reading of this is that, you know, they needed a couple more guys to kind of fill out the band. And Roger McGuinn was already thinking of doing an album or a double album, I guess it was, that, with that sort of would encompass like the history of like American music.
It was very ambitious
in, you know, in Byrds, you know, new Byrds music and maybe some covers and things like that. I don't know what his idea was, but that was the whole idea, was going to go through a bunch of different styles. And Graham Parsons, who people, you know, may also know later on, did some work with the Rolling Stones and then was Flying Burrito Brothers with Chris Hillman. Graham Parsons came in and just had this vision. He just wanted to focus on like a rock band playing country music.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like that was what he wanted to do. And somehow he managed to kind of like hijack the band, right?
It's kind of amazing. And Chris Hillman, who had played in a bluegrass band before he joined the Byrds, was happy to go in that direction because that was a lot of his roots anyway. And McGuinn was like, okay, you know, he kind of went with it. And eventually that very ambitious agenda that you talked about sort of went by the wayside. And, you know, it's interesting, Jim, there's only two original songs on this record, on the original version of it, and they were both written by Graham Parsons. And so all the rest were you know, covers. Interestingly enough, I know this album is credited as being the first major sort of country rock album, but Graham Parsons, before he joined the Byrds, was in a band called the International Submarine Band, and they put out a record called Safe at Home that probably, if you had to stick a pin in one album, like complete album, that was the first country rock album, that would probably be the one. Dylan and the, you know, the band were doing stuff up in Woodstock, but nobody really had heard that at that point. And then John Wesley Harding had some country elements, but not a lot. Some people say the Beatles had covered Buck Owens, you know, pretty early on. Well, that was interesting,
and
too.
And supposedly Graham noted that.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that he was like, oh, if a rock band can do that, then, you know, my idea is not so crazy, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Nashville Skyline came a little bit later,
Bit later. That was the second post-motorcycle accident. Yeah,
the next 69. Year.
And that's when Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan, you know, Dylan went on the Johnny Cash show and they did Girl from the North Country and a lot of that stuff too.
I mean, I think you and I were texting back and forth earlier about a band that we may end up talking about a little bit too, but I do think it's also of note in some way that the first Creedence Clearwater Revival album came out in 1968.
Yep.
So, you know, you wouldn't necessarily call that country rock, but certainly there's a lot of country influence in John Fogerty's work.
Mm-hmm.
And that was right around this same time too. So there was definitely kind of something happening here. But Sweetheart of the Rodeo really went all in
on
the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we should hear something here.
Yeah,
so what would you like to play?
Well, why don't we just go ahead and hear their cover of the Leuven Brothers' The Christian Life, which I think really kind of represents how country they actually went on this record.
My buddies tell me that I should have waited. They say I'm missing a whole world of fun. But I still love them and I sing with pride. I like the Christian life. I won't lose a friend by heeding God's call. For what is a friend who'd want you to fall? Others find pleasure in things I despise. I like the Christian life.
let me ask you a question about this song. So as you mentioned, it's a classic country song.
Yeah.
You can hear there that they're playing it pretty faithfully, right? Now, Graham Parsons, I don't think, you know, doesn't necessarily live this life that he's describing here, but yet it doesn't come off as though they're doing it ironically.
No, not at all. No, they really feel it and really knew how to play this music, and it was part of them for some reason. Yeah. And, you know, obviously McGuinn had folk roots and Graham Parsons had really deep country roots too. So that really came across. And I think also the clarity, they got a great recording on this record. Like, the sound is fantastic. They were using a first class studio paid for by CBS. And the pedal steel on this track, J.D. Manis and Clarence White is playing the electric guitar. So they had some secret weapons as far as Clarence White played a lot of the really interesting electric guitar parts. Lloyd Green played some pedal steel on this record. So they brought in some really good country musicians to kind of give it just the right sort of accent. Yeah. So it was like pretty much first class Nashville cats playing on some of these tracks.
So what is really interesting about this, I think, is even though it's a rock band playing country music, mm-hmm. in no way are they making fun of it.
No, not at all.
Or even trying to put some, you know, kind of stamp on it to make old country seem old. They're playing it in a way to bring this music to their rock audience.
Yeah, that's right.
And mm-hmm. say, you know, if you don't think this is good, or you somehow dismiss it as less than, you're really missing out.
Yeah.
And we're going to, you know, play this, bring it to you and show you, you know, why you should pay attention.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I think that's exactly right. And you feel their enthusiasm for the music when you listen to it.
And I think Graham Parsons, he felt somehow that there was a certain purity to country music that didn't, you know, necessarily come through in rock and roll, because mm-hmm. rock and roll is sort of a mishmash of a bunch of styles, right? But it's sort of like, let's get to something that's really real and really pure. And this is where his heart was.
Yeah, it went down to the roots. And what's so interesting to me, there's a lot of legends and stories about this record, but by the time it came out, Graham Parsons was out of the band. He'd fallen out.
I know,
with
isn't
McGuinn.
That weird?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And McGuinn went back and recut several of over top of Graham Parsons' vocals, using his vocals as a guide. But Graham Parsons only has three, you know, solo lead vocals on this album. And McGuinn went back and cut a bunch of them himself. I believe The Christian Life was one of those.
Yeah.
But he was using Graham's original leads and templates for it.
And many years later, you can find those original. They re-released some these tracks mm-hmm. with the Graham Parsons vocals too. Yeah, it's such a bizarre story, because, like I said, you hire in a guy to be in the band, and he ends up sort of really kind of taking over the band to a large extent. And
it's
then,
amazing.
And then before the album even comes out, he's left the band.
I know. like, and took the bass player with him.
Yeah.
And they went on to do the Flying Burrito Brothers. And, you know, that first album, The Gilded Palace of Sin, I think Graham Parsons sort of considered, well, here's what I was trying to do the whole time, and this is where we really got it together. But I don't know. For me, they're equally great.
And if you listen to those classic Graham Parsons solo albums that came out in the 70s, GP and Grievous Angel, right? Mm-hmm. Definitely you can draw a straight line to Sweetheart of the Rodeo from that. I mean, this was his vision. This is what he wanted to do. He got really fortunate to be able to work with an established band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without that, who knows where he would have gone as a solo artist, right? But then he was able to sort of complete that vision a little bit later on, a few years later on.
So. Yeah. And, you know, there's also a lot of conversation and conjecture about, because Graham Parsons came to the forefront with the Byrds and suddenly was on a much higher, you know, level. I mean, the Byrds actually played at the Grand Ole Opry, believe it or not, although they were apparently roundly dismissed by most of the people there. He was able to get to a level where he suddenly became friends with the Rolling Stones. And there's a lot of people who say, how much country, you know, how much influence did Graham Parsons have on the Stones country phase, like Wild Horses and all the, you know, the rambles they did on Exile and all that.
I think
he must have.
And he was part of those Muscle Shoals sessions that they did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, I think he had a big influence on, you know, Mick, but I think probably especially Keith.
He was one of the few people who could go like toe to toe with with Keith as far as imbibing and substances, I think, too. He could, like, match him.
So you mentioned there's a couple of original songs.
Yeah, and they're both quite
here.
Beautiful.
Let's hear one. This is sung by Graham Parsons, Hickory Wind.
In South Carolina, there are many tall pines. I remember the oak tree that we used to climb. But now when I'm lonesome, I always pretend that I'm getting the feel of hickory wind. I've started out at most everything, all the riches and pleasure, what else can life bring? But it makes me feel better each time.
Amazingly beautiful song.
I think it's a gorgeous song. And, you know, really, that's just a Graham Parsons solo song,
yeah,
you know?
It is.
But again, really think about this. You're sitting there in 1968 and you hear this, you're like, this is the band that did 8 Miles High?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah,
you know,
it's crazy.
It's such a radical mm-hmm. departure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to... I know there's other examples of that in rock history,
yeah,
but it's, you
not
know,
that many.
But not that many,
no.
Where you just completely just say, like,
yeah,
we're going in a totally different yeah. direction. Right.
And it's funny.
And make it really good.
I know. You know? That's the other thing about yeah. it. And, you know, they were known, obviously, right out of the gate as being a band that interpreted Dylan songs. Yet on this album, they open and close the record with very country interpretations of Dylan songs, you know. You Ain't Going Nowhere and Nothing Was Delivered. Nothing Was Delivered eventually became kind of a staple of the Basement Tapes, but it's kind of amazing how they interpreted the guy who was the folk rock guy in such an incredible country way. And they also cover Merle Haggard on this record.
Yes.
And then William Bell, who was a Stax guy. So
I'd like to play that.
Yeah.
We can play out with that one.
Sure.
I think,
you don't miss your water.
Again, I think that's interesting from modern standpoint, too.
Yeah.
This notion of taking a soul song and making it a country song, mm-hmm. but from a rock perspective,
yeah.
right? It's like that to me seems very much like Americana.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, 2018, right? That approach.
That really goes to Graham's kind of philosophy, whether it's legend or he actually really lived by it, this cosmic American music
yes.
philosophy he had, but you can really hear it in that song.
Yeah. All right. That'll be a good one.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing I want to mention about the two Dylan tracks here mm-hmm. is I find this fascinating too, that the Byrds, I guess because they had so much success with the other Dylan songs, they had like this pipeline to like Dylan
yeah,
music, because these were songs that Dylan had not yet released.
No, he hadn't, and he was, you know, working on them up there in Woodstock with the band and the Basement Tapes. Yeah,
so basically the manager was like, here's some demos from Bob Dylan
yeah.
and check these out, and maybe you can put your take on these songs. So.
And one of them seemingly about a guy who was supposed to deliver them drugs and didn't actually do it. They held him hostage until he delivered.
All right, let's get out of here.
All right.
This is good. This
really
is good
stuff.
And I think, you know, again, I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with this
yeah.
album. If you're not, go check it out.
Oh,
it really is a beautiful record. And it's one of those great records, you know, kind of in a way like Velvet Underground or you know, Big Star
mm-hmm.
or, you know, there's lots of others in rock history that just have become much, much bigger over time and were not appreciated at
yeah.
the time they were released.
I think that's well said. And, you know, it's interesting to me, too, for the Birds, you could say, oh, I really love the Birds. Well, what's your favorite Birds album? Well, I can't answer that because there's like three distinct phases of the right. Birds. You know, I'd have to pick Sweetheart as their country album and maybe Notorious Bird Brothers as their kind of weird psychedelic album. And then maybe, you know, Turn as their folk rock album. It's kind of incredible.
But to me, this is almost really isn't even a Birds album.
Not really.
You know
it
what
really
I mean?
Isn't, yeah.
I feel like this is such
a good
kind of like singular piece of work.
It really is.
With really just like one person's very strong vision mm-hmm. who was barely even in the band.
I know. You know? It's kind of incredible. So, and McGuinn and Hillman obviously embraced that and really went
did.
With it. That says a lot about them.
Although apparently McGuinn wasn't totally on board yeah. and had to be convinced. And then, like you said, he went back in and sort of, you know, after... Parsons had left and went back in and redid some of the vocals himself,
yeah.
maybe to even downplay Graham
yeah,
Parsons' contribution. Mm-hmm. Roger McGuinn's a great singer, so I don't think anybody's going to complain about that.
No.
But the point is, obviously, Chris Hillman really got into it because he and Graham Parsons later, you know, did this kind of
yeah.
music in another band. So.
Right. And you know what's interesting? If any of our listeners, there in 2018, this year, at some point, there was a 50th anniversary tour with Chris Hillman
yes.
and Roger McGuinn, backed by, I think, Marty Stewart's band or somebody's
yeah.
band. If anybody saw that, I didn't see it. I don't think you saw it. But if anybody saw it, we'd love to hear
yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you went to it.
I had heard, I can't remember, if it was one of my friends was planning to go to that at the Strathmore, I think.
Oh, is that where it was?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've been reading about it too. So that's interesting because
yeah.
all these years later, obviously Roger McGuinn and, you know, certainly Chris Hillman, they really understand what they did.
Yeah,
at
the legacy
time, you
for
know?
Sure.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. It's kind of, you know, in a way I almost, not sound-wise or even necessarily ambition-wise, but just sort of in the way an album is so different from what the band had been doing to that point and over time has become appreciated as sort of a masterpiece. I sort of equate this too with Pet Sounds.
Oh, interesting.
You know,
yeah.
in that way mm-hmm. that, and also in that way that like Pet Sounds was totally like Brian Wilson's record and the rest of the band wasn't really on board.
Right.
You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? And it sort of changed from that moment on the way people thought of the Beach Boys,
completely
right?
Completely altered their career.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is not exactly the same, but it's similar in that
yeah.
way. And so the point being that 50 years later, this is the one that people want to celebrate.
Yeah.
You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Yeah, exactly right. And it's interesting to me, the post Sweetheart Birds albums are pretty hit and miss. You know, there's
right.
not a whole lot where you'd say, wow, this is great from start to finish.
Right. All right. We've gone really long.
Okay.
Tomorrow, we're going to go to 1978.
Something a little different.
Up. Yeah, a little
about
different.
About as different as you can get, actually.
A little different. That's right. So get ready for that. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
If you guys want to mention any thoughts you have on Sweetheart of the Rodeo,
mm-hmm.
you can call 612-440-1984 or email rock@suburbspod.com or find us on the social media is all that you know where to find us at Suburbs Pod. Okay, we're going to play out with You Don't Miss Your Water. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you guys tomorrow. But when you left me
he was one of the few people who could go like toe to toe with Keith as far as imbibing and substances.